What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody. Hello.
We've got a jam-packed episode this week with two special guests, and we'll be talking about the crazy wild world of AI video. And certainly, it's probably a pretty good week to do that because things happened, which we didn't plan, but which are completely absurd and totally real, including stuff shared by the president and the vice president. So yeah, we'll dive into that. And we also have the reviews of the Apple M5 hardware. I did the MacBook Pro M5. We've got some thoughts on the iPad Pro M5 as well. But mainly this is going to be about AI video and kind of where we're at with some people who do a lot of reporting and analysis around that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. And yeah, if you send us a question, it could be used on the show. It could be used in our Ask Engadget section. Also, join us Thursday mornings on our live stream on YouTube to see us live. Sometimes we'll show off gadgets and we'll often do Q&As with you guys. So stay tuned for all of that. Let's get into AI video because a couple things have happened. OpenAI released its Sora app a couple of weeks ago, which is their sort of like TikTok app for producing AI video, which can also create very realistic versions of yourself, of your own avatar. And also things have been shared around as, the political climate in the U.S. gets more and more absurd. There was recently a video shared by the president of this country, an AI version of Donald Trump, where he basically, he flew in a fighter jet and dumped poop all over Americans as a response to the No Kings protest. That's fun. That's a fun reality we're living in. So to help us talk about AI poop and AI videos and all that fun stuff, we've got Drew Harwell, technology reporter at The Washington Post. Hey, Drew.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing okay. And also Jeremy Carrasco is joining us. He posts as Show Tools AI on TikTok and other platforms. You've probably seen his videos. What's up, Jeremy?
Hey, doing well. Great to be here.
All right. Drew, you report on disinformation and the dark side of technology and the internet these days. And Jeremy, like, you're somebody who understands video just like on a broad level. How screwed are we right now with the state of AI video, right? Because we have very realistic video technology coming from folks like OpenAI. They're trying to push it out faster with something like Sora. And then we have people in power with influence who are also spreading like just AI garbage willy-nilly. What is your sense of where we are right now with the state of AI video?
There is a certain accelerationism in AI that has gotten into video, and it has really ruined the information ecosystem already. People are already freaking out.
I tell you.
I get a lot of people sending me videos to ask me if they're AI or not. More than half of the videos I get now are real videos, not AI videos. So it has completely freaked people out. Now, granted, I'll admit that people self-select to me, and that's not a representative sample, but there is an element there of people not understanding what's true or not. And it's generally being pushed by the tech companies who view video as part of their overall AGI push, and video must be a part of that, even though it doesn't really seem like they have a good plan for it and don't seem to be paying attention to the harm it's maybe even doing to their own messaging. So I don't even think it's very self-serving of them. So I think even though the AI videos are still detectable, culturally, we are in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, Drew, thoughts?
Agreed. Yeah. For all these videos, like the top comment is always like, we're cooked, chat. Like,
yeah.
We're cooked.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I try not to be fatalist. But, you know, the unique elements here are just that it's video, right? It is so compelling. It's so colorful and rich. And I think we all kind of like baked it into our minds that the text we were reading online, the accounts we were seeing, were probably, you know, we've expected them to be bots and fake for a long time. But video was always kind of that like rare thing that seemed like it was going to be too hard to do realistic fakes at scale of anybody. And I still remember the like relatively crude kind of deep fakes of several years ago, and just the pace with which they've gotten to a point of way past the uncanny valley of just being very realistic. And the fact that the company, I assume we'll talk about this, but that the company's like guardrails are so weak and so porous and so easily leapt over, it just all combined to this factor that's really kind of societally scary.
So Drew, my question for you is, like, it's crazy enough that the president and vice president reposted AI videos that weren't made by anyone in federal government. Like, they're made by, like, the MAGA, like, internet ecosystem meme smiths. But they still look pretty cartoonish. So what's the big difference here between like these videos that were posted this past weekend and like a really convincing Photoshop from 2016 or like a Bush era Jib Jab video?
Yeah, it is basically Jib Jab. And I think, I'm old enough to remember, and I covered it, you know, the first Trump 1.0, right? There was this army of MAGA meme lords who were very proud, you know, who did like, you know, Photoshop, very cartoony stuff. And they were basically grassroots, but they would hope to get the clout and recognition from like a Trump or now a J.D. Vance retweet. And at the time, you know, some people could be convinced, you know, there was always this joke about boomers would be sharing them on Facebook. They would think they were realistic. That still happens. And it's really not dissimilar to the very kind of like goofy cartoon. You know, I don't think anybody expects that Trump was really in a fighter jet with his mask down here, like dumping poop on, you know, left-wing influencers. But it's really not that far of a leap from that kind of goofy stuff to the stuff that is more realistic. Like there was a video of like Barack Obama being arrested and it wasn't goofy. It was like, it was made to be a news video. And, you know, Jeremy and I and everybody has probably seen a lot of these videos where people are trying to ape the style of news video, like history video, like, and they're not being goofy at all and they're not disclosing it at all. So, you know, if you can make a really compelling, goofy meme AI, you can also make something that will fool more and more people. And the other thing is, like, even if it's not fooling people, there's still a, like, the reason why AI is so powerful for propaganda is because it gives you an emotion. Like it's why there's so much AI rage bait, but also like AI hope bait. Like there was this pastor that Jeremy and I also did a video on where he was like railing against billionaires, and I saw it and I was like, wow, this is cool. Like I shared it to some reporters who were reporting on billionaires, and then I realized like way too late that it was actually just fake. And it was like, okay, so this activated the emotion in me, and then I shared it, and then I helped this AI like slop lord get more clicks. And so it's like you can tell why it's such a compelling system, because it activates us inside.
I came across that video as well, and I feel like I also fell for it, but it was also like I didn't share it, but I sort of saw it for like 5 seconds on TikTok. I was like, huh, that's interesting. Maybe this pastors like this are actually becoming more activated against like the threat of billionaires or whatever that specific video was. And then I realized after the fact it was fake, because I saw another TikTok video. I think it was you, Jeremy, that was breaking down how it was AI. But it's that sort of scary half recognition of it, like just as you're swiping through your feed, oh, that's kind of interesting. And you keep going. It plants in your head. You don't clock it's AI, but it plants that idea that that thing could be real. And that's why all this stuff is so dangerous. Something we keep talking about on the show is that all the AI companies are just deploying these products and services without like respect towards the harm that they're causing. And I think with video especially, that seems like the most dangerous thing, right? Because you can literally make anything happen. There were the people using Sora to create videos of people like that they were stealing, you know, fake videos of people stealing stuff at Target or wherever. We are just so unprepared for all of this. And honestly, it's not really heartening seeing the response from the technology side. Ben, I think you had some more questions you wanted to go through.
Yeah, Jeremy, could you tell which models were used to generate these videos that Trump and Vance posted? And if so, like, what are the tells? What are the, like, markers that it's, you know, VO versus Sora versus anything else?
I'm glad you asked, because this is a great question that I think gets down to, like, where the guardrails actually are. So, in short, because it wasn't J.D. Vance or Trump creating it, they had to ironically use, I think, a Chinese AI to make that video.
That's so funny.
Yeah, because so by Chinese AI, though, that doesn't mean some obscure thing. Just to be clear about that could be Kling. Like, Kling's a big name. So what they probably did was, it looked like the Trump mask, for example, had the yellowy ChatGPT, like 4.0 look. Like, they probably created that in 4.0, maybe did some editing there, put that into Kling. They probably used a separate video AI for the poop dumping on the protesters, because from what I can tell, that was a real photo taken and they animated it with the poop dropping on them, right? So there are various different types of techniques they used, from like probably Chinese AIs, but it could have been Veo doing that. It doesn't look like it was Sora. It didn't look like Sora to me. And, you know, people see these, and because Sora has all the attention right now, they assume that it's Sora. It's actually not. So Sora wouldn't have actually let you do that unless you found an exploit, which was possible. But visually, I could tell that wasn't Sora. So I know that's not what happened there. But yeah, the guardrails are even worse for other companies, which, to, you know, OpenAI will use that as a way to justify why they should be the ones making these. But you know, Sora's leaps and bounds ahead of a lot of other AIs. That argument falls apart pretty quickly. But I mean, there is something to be said for Google Veo, for example, having a few more guardrails that would prevent you from making a video of Trump unless it was Trump himself doing it, and they would have to find a workaround there.
So that's really interesting, because I think when people talk about like AI slop in quotations, they often talk about someone typing a single sentence in and then going like, ha 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 ha, like I made something. You're saying that there was some real human effort and like multiple models that went into just this, what, like 15 or 20 second video with Kenny Loggins over it?
Yeah, that one specifically, yes. The innovation of Sora 2 is that you can just generate engaging looking things with just a sentence. But in that case, because they were using older tools, yes, they would have actually had to storyboard that out, not specifically, but have a little bit of a plan, go in with each one and try to tell a story. Whereas Sora, you don't need to do that. You can just give it President, I mean, if you were to get through the guardrails, you could just give it President, you know, takes off, drops poop on protesters. That, like, you could tell Sora 2 that, and it would do it, if not for the safety guardrails that would prevent it from being President Trump in that case, right? But in the older tools that they use, yes, they would have had to specifically storyboard all those out. But I think that's getting to why Sora 2 is what you're seeing everywhere right now, which is that, like, if Google had released a social network with Veo, it would have been an awful, completely boring experience, because Veo, you have to talk to it like you're a director. Sora 2, you can just tell it what you want, and it has an LLM layer in there that will inject it with more interesting stuff if you're not a good enough prompter, which is why like the volume of that is so high. We're seeing a lot more good-looking slop through Sora because it does a lot of the work for you, even if, you know, on Veo it would have been boring and awful.
Again, the story of modern technology, right? Like the more seamless they make these tools, the more like inherently dangerous it becomes. Like it is, it's kind of gross. A point I wanted to make is that so much of the way we regulate this stuff, not even considering like government regulations, just like as a society, how we consider things, it's all norms based, right? You will reject something. I think when Google Glass came out, collectively we were like, no, we don't want Borg faces. We don't want Borg people. Get that out of here. And that is kind of happening with AI video, but also at the same time, like when Trump, when JD Vance are using these things or sharing them around, it does normalize it to the point where it's just like, oh yeah, just a silly thing, just a silly, silly internet gaffe, you know, that that our president sends out. How long ago President Obama was criticized heavily for wearing a tan suit at one point, like the sort of like state of the world that we're living in is just like, I don't know. It's just getting so much worse, and AI video is just making it all so much worse because of that. So, damn, it's just kind of a disheartening thing at this point.
And the crazy thing about the Trump and Vance videos is, again, how cartoony they were next to some of the really convincing things that we've seen this year, like bunnies jumping on a trampoline, an interracial couple on the New York City subway, an emotional support kangaroo in the airport. And so this sets up a question for Drew, which is, when you started reporting a story that you did in August about people who make these kind of emotionally stirring AI videos for money, did you start with the frame of these people are doing it for cash, or did you find that more of them were doing it for cash than for like the love of the game and watching something go viral?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did kind of basically expect most of them were doing it for cash. You know, I write about the creator economy. That's the juice, right? That's why a lot of people do it. What I did find was that you asked about, like, you know, writing a sentence to make a slop video. There is a big spectrum, right? There are people who kind of treat this as a as an art form, and how, you know, they combine these tools. And I think I will say there is some artistic talent and selection and editorial choicing that does go into some of these AI videos. They're really cool, like,
well, for sure.
AI,
yeah,
like actual AI art videos. But then you dial all the way back to the other side of the spectrum, and there's just a flood of people who are doing the lowest common denominator. You know, the videos take 5 seconds, but then they can create an industrial workflow where they're pumping out 100 a day, and there's no penalty for them dumping quantity onto a TikTok account. So you'll go onto these accounts and there will be like 100 loser videos and then one video that gets a million views. That is a successful day for them. And so it's like this incentive, and they can make money off of that. They can make attention. They can do whatever. So there's basically this incentive structure set up to encourage more slop. Like, we're encouraging more low grade, just crap, like funneling onto these social media platforms. So if you're a creator and you're trying to make one good video that people will find interesting, you're going to be fighting all of that. So, you know, it was interesting to me because a lot of these people I talked to, they do not have a technical background, an AI background. They're just using the tools. And, you know, the tools are free. They're very easy. There's, like you said, there's no friction. It encourages experimentation and playing around. So a lot of these were people who were like, you know, I talked to one young woman who's like basically putting her college degree on pause so she can make more AI video. And she's like streaming. She's trying to create this business out of it. There are people who are treating it basically like a small business. And in some ways, like, they're working from home making this stuff. So in some ways, it's like, okay, this is a labor story. Like with anything on social media, like, these are people treating it like a job. But then you see the output of all their work and energy, and it's just like, to make a better fart video that gets like 10 more clicks. It's just like kind of dispiriting in that way.
This is overall, like, I think a pretty negative AI video conversation, just because we're looking at it at like a broad aspect. Somebody in the chat points out, though, Deepro9, regular viewer and listener, points out that they made a high quality commercial for their business that cost next to nothing via Sora. Not perfect, but they're happy with the results. And they're like, that is certainly going to be a legitimate use case for some people. I don't know if you guys have encountered AI videos like in the wild now, but I go to a lot of movies. I also post a movie podcast, so I'm in the theater often. I'm sitting through theater ads and local ads, and my God, have they gotten terrible. Like, I think a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I run a small local business. I can just whip something up with AI. And it is dispiriting. It is just like pure garbage that you're watching. It's not as if local businesses had big budgets for commercials before or made great commercials, but there was something, like, I don't know, kind of cheesy, kind of human about a guy being like, hey, come to my restaurant. We got this stuff. And seeing the more highly polished and looks like bad CG coming from AI videos, it is so inhuman. To me, it doesn't really sell those businesses well. It may depend on the business. But have you guys encountered AI video outside of like the stuff being shared on social, just people using it day to day?
I just want to say that my channel is called Show Tools AI because when I started, I was much more optimistic about this. Like, I just want to be very plain about that. I came from a professional production background where I was helping small businesses, but I was also doing some very large productions. And I thought that there was optimism. I actually thought that the AI companies were doing such a bad job communicating. It's like, okay, maybe I can like help figure out what's going on here. But as it starts to play out, so yes, there are possible good ways to use it. However, that does not justify the larger societal harm of these tools. So right. Just because it right. unlocks a small business use case. Now, and then DaVinci, you bring up a good point. Is it actually a good use? Like, would it actually have just yeah. been better for you to film something with your phone and make a personal connection? Because at the end of the day, there was never friction for creating. It's like, you had tools to do it. And for most people, just using your phone and talking to a camera personably is going to be a better use of your time, the energy in the world. Like, it's just overall a better use. And I found myself just looking for more ways. It's like, what if I use it for my backgrounds and my green screen? It's like, ah, no, like, it's stolen. And it's like, oh, it takes forever to generate. And I'm having to burn like 5 generations, which, you know, on Midjourney is 20 generations to get one decent good green screen background. It's like, why am I doing this? Because at the end of the day, and when Drew was talking about, you know, who he's talking about or who is making these aren't video professionals. And the reason why is because making AI video sucks. It really sucks. If you're a true creative professional, your brain doesn't work as in like translating text into like when you're making movies, you make storyboards. Like there are other ways to communicate this, right? So it's not a direct path creatively at all. So what it's best at is making slop. That's what it is optimized for. It is not optimized for high quality visuals. There are companies that are trying to use it, professional production companies with moderate success. They might try to work it into a VFX workflow. Okay, like totally understand that argument. That is not what these AI companies are going for, though. Like Runway is trying to do that. They've seen a lot of rejection. They're getting some successes, right? Does that justify the existence of Sora 2 or VO 3? I certainly don't think so, because the creative uses aren't that good. And at the end of the day, it's still stolen data and it's still sloppy. So it's just, we didn't ever have that much friction. So there's just this idea of like, oh, I can get like a seemingly good looking cinematic quality video. It's like, it might look that way to you, but to the normal person, they can tell it's slop. It doesn't look any better than just using your phone. So I don't think it's actually enabling that much more. And this has been a little bit of like a, like that industry line has worked, but the people I know aren't finding much use for mm-hmm. it.
Drew, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's really well said. You know, and the thing that has always, I think this is a concept to understand with all AI creation, is that like these videos are not perfect, but they are, people think of them as like good enough. You know, they realize like, I could do this a better way. I could hire an animator or a video creator, or, you know, to do it the right way, to not have stolen video. But it just looks, I mean, that's part of what makes it slop, is it's just kind of like formless, like tasteless, just like goo that doesn't have, you know, the creativity that you would expect from something that you would make in a different way. So it, yeah, it's like I understand kind of the small business who's using it for video. I feel like I drive around now and every time I see a logo on like a contractor truck, yes, that's like for plumbing or something, I'm like, that was AI made. Like, it's just like a stick. It's like stick art, you know, it's like clip art. And I just think about like, are we, you know, not to get too like philosophical, but like, what are
Let's
we doing
get philosophical.
To our like,
yeah.
our like broad levels of like societal taste that we're sanding off the edges of everything creative and going for just like the base median of everything that we've seen before creativity, you know, and if it's like a local business plumbing commercial, maybe we shouldn't care about it, but that's the form that's encompassing everything now. And so, and you're now seeing like Netflix using AI video to do like individual scenes and part of bigger cinematic products. You know, Netflix did not have an issue making those scenes before, right? They would pay animators who were really good at it. But now they're like, oh, we can do it for cheaper and the explosion will look, you know, 50% as good, but people are going to be scrolling through their phones anyway. Who cares? So it's just like, but, you know, it's like a ship of Theseus thing. Like we're replacing one screw at a time and making the things we ingest like a little bit crappier along the way. And we're not going to stop until it's a completely different product and we're all.
And also, if I can, the other thing to mention here, because I know this kind of conversation can come off as like, oh, a bunch of established professionals, like you guys don't understand. And like, I get that. But here's the thing that I think that the very optimistic, I see the, oh, if I could have infinite Netflix creating exactly what I wanted, that would be great. Okay. So in order for that sort of technology to become ubiquitous, you have to understand it does not exist in a vacuum. It is not sticking inside Netflix. It is not sticking. It is going to be everywhere. If you can have infinite Netflix, none of your social media feeds are real anymore. It is completely collapsed the meaning of the media we see. So even in these hyper optimistic, techno optimistic, oh, if we can just enable so many people to be so creative, how great will that be? It's going to just be slop everywhere. It's going to fold the meaning of media onto itself. No one will be watching anything anymore. It collapses the entire system. So you're not playing it all the way through to its logical conclusion. That's my opinion there.
I feel that like we have a lot of AI conversations on my movie podcast as well. And like the thing I kind of have settled on is that I think the audience knows. I think on a fundamental human level, we can kind of tell when things look off. Like that's kind of the key to the whole the vacuum thing, the thing where something looks too real but a little bit off.
Uncanny Valley.
If you hear about like kids today, like kids in grade school, and I hear this all the time, the whole thing where they see something that looks a little too weird or a little too hyper realistic, they're like, that's AI. That's AI is a common refrain. It's a common like way of describing something now among the younger generation who's growing up amidst all this stuff. I think on a fundamental level, like maybe audiences will notice that too. Because like audiences can tell when a movie looks bad. I look at like Disney spent $150 million on Tron Ares. Nobody wanted that movie. Like that was a legacy project created because of their own corporate algorithm that they thought that could be a hit. And audiences fully rejected it. And I think on a fundamental level, like when it comes to like putting AI in things or producing AI only things, like there will be some sort of rejection. But on a like a brief little anecdote here, I spent a couple hours or maybe an hour with Sora recently when I got access to it. And it's all trash. Like the entire feed of videos is complete trash. Just like people trying out, you know, their own like little prompts and stuff, but it doesn't generate any emotion or feeling for me other than look what I could do. I can make you know, anything I can type into this prompt. And then I spent 5 minutes on TikTok and I'm like genuinely entertained by stuff being created by humans, silly situations. Like that's not like professional media, but it's just like people sharing, oh man, look at the way this car cut me off in traffic. And like, I put some funny music around it. It's not high quality media, but it's very human. It's something we can all relate to. And the AI products will never have that. They will only ever be recycled.
And this is not old man yelling at clouds, by the way.
Yeah.
This is like, just to be clear, like you are saying the young person opinion here. A lot of the people who are like, you're an old man who wants ancient technology. No. The older people are the ones who are more into this, just to be clear. This is a huge misconception. And whenever I get someone just be like, oh, you're so old fashioned, it's like, no, I'm not. I'm the one who's paying attention to this, man.
Yeah, I wanted to say, like, we are not, like, coming from the connoisseur standpoint where we're demanding, like, high fidelity media and all. I'm going to be really interested in the next couple of years how the younger generations are. I think they're already starting to assess this stuff. AI is just becoming typecasted as low quality. This actually happened. There was, like, a Nicki Minaj, like, album cover or something where they used AI in it. And people just like basically were like revolted by it. They were just like, why are you giving, you know? And so it's just and, you know, I have heard about like I was just talking to somebody who was saying like all the kids in my third graders classroom love Sora. They think it's interesting. And, you know, but like I'm not going to create a moral panic about like what we watch because Skippity Toilet is popular for a reason. Like people find it funny. Like I'm not demanding that they all be reading like Proust or anything. But, you know. My hopium comes from a place of like you, Devendra, where it's like the more we see this AI stuff and the more it just kind of washes over us and we're immersed in it and we see the patterns of it and the novelty wears off, the more I think we're going to like enjoy people being weird and creative and making literally new things, not just things that, and I will say, you know, in Sora's defense, the feed is mostly garbage. There some creative touches. And actually, OpenAI brought this up too, where they were like, we love what everybody's creating. We really want to call out the Japanese creators. You guys are making some really cool stuff. And I will say, like, on the feed, you'll see these cool, like, just weird, like, anime-style videos. And you can see the prompts, and they're, like, super intricate. And I think like, wow, that's really cool. Somebody made that with AI. That is kind of like artistic. They're clearly making choices. They're defining the attributes they find interesting. But what we're really seeing here, and I think it's okay for people to enjoy that, but what we're really seeing is like, this is a really good carbon copy of anime that came before it. Like they really learned how to, you know, train the model to go to reverse engineer the things I like, and they made it in a new way, and I think that's really cool. And like, we're so far away from like this stuff being used in actual storytelling in a way that like is interesting more than 8 seconds at a time. I think it's possible we will get there as more people like, you know, combine these things and play around. But just at the point that's why I think people are going to be bouncing off it really hard.
Gotcha. Go ahead, Ben. Any other questions? Because we're taking up all your time, guys. We're going to wrap up soon. But Ben, I'm sure you had some final thoughts on all this.
Yeah. And of course, people are jackhammering right outside my window right now. So thank God for plugins. I'll be able to clean this up later.
Useful AI tools.
Yeah, true. The tool that I use is machine learning based. So big question for Jeremy A couple of weeks ago, you made a video about how easy it was to make like a really compelling anime version of Diego Maradona's goal of the century. You said that it felt like a sign that humans are about to be cut out of the equation for making viral AI videos. Because I compare the prompt you used to make that goal of the century video and a prompt that I saw on Sora just last night of someone who wanted to make like one of those kind of food porn cooking videos, and the prompt was so detailed down to the color temperature of the lights and the kind of lenses they thought would look best. Can you talk more about how you think people are going to be cut out of this equation?
I think people will be cut out of part of the equation. When it's funny, when I see the really detailed prompts, I'm like, you guys are just giving Sora all of your IP, essentially. It's like, if the only thing separating Sora from doing this and you is your prompt, Sora is actually collecting your prompts. So that's about to go away. I think that there will still be a place for human-made content in Sora, but ultimately, most of your generations in Sora are wasted. OpenAI is essentially subsidizing everybody's slop feed right now. I think that there's going to be incredible incentive for OpenAI to just create the most engaging infinite scrolling algorithm ever by just injecting another, you know, injecting the prompts themselves. I just think that this is maybe a year away. I'm not going to make some sort of grand claim that it's going to replace everybody in the slop feed, but I just think that if you are an AI creator and you're giving OpenAI all of your prompts, you have to realize you're giving away everything, because they can see how your prompts perform. They can see how they're treated. So it's not even a mildly difficult jump to get there. And then I would again just remind people that, like, I understand that the AI video is going to get better. That doesn't mean people are going to want it more. People might actually be more scared and reject it more. So just improving technology does not make people want it. That's not how this works when people feel like they're being replaced. They might revolt against it. So in a year, we are probably going to be at a point, because the technology is already there. It's just about OpenAI connecting the dots, right? This isn't some grand extrapolation. We're going to be at a point where OpenAI can generate extremely high quality Sora 2 Pro videos of most of the same quality that you're seeing now. And they don't really need humans there, and they might not want humans there for the majority of the feed, because humans are very dumb and wasteful and are stealing all their content and posting it to TikTok and Instagram, where they don't make any money.
Definitely. You know what, Drew, Jeremy, this was a great conversation. I want to bring you guys back on at some point to like check in on the state of where we're at, because we could talk for hours. And I don't know, I have a lot of feelings about this. I'm sure our audience does too. Ben, any final thoughts? Because I would love to hear where people can find these folks work on the internet too.
Just one last question for Jeremy. Is there any model in particular this year who has had, or that has had, more hits than the others?
You mean AI model?
Yes.
Sora 2, by far. Sora 2 default. No question. It is.
And that is free. What? How many weeks old is that now?
Four? Three?
Wow.
Three. It's 3 weeks old. Yeah, it was October 1st. So 3 weeks old. But it's because anyone can do it. It's essentially free. Like, all you need is a Sora invite code, and then you screen cap it on your desktop and post it to Instagram. It's not, that's why. It doesn't look better than VO3. It's just, it's free.
It's free. It's broadly accessible. It's totally a thing. All right. Drew, Jeremy, where can we find you folks on the internet these days?
WashingtonPost.com, of course, but also Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky, Threads, not
what's your username?
Anywhere else. Drew Harwell.
All right. And Jeremy?
I'm at ShowToolsAI everywhere. Jeremy Carrasco on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and maybe eventually Blue Sky and TikTok, though.
Yeah, I would love to see you more on Blue Sky, just for the chats, conversations. But thank you, folks. All right, let's move on to some chat about the most recent Apple devices. I spent a lot of time with the MacBook Pro M5, the 14-inch version. That's the only one that's out right now. And it's good. It's fine. Go check out my review. Gave it a score of 92 out of 100. What do you expect, though? Like, Apple didn't make the MacBook Pro any worse. It's still, like, the same great professional laptop I've always liked. The thing about the M5 chip that I noticed is that the graphics are so much better. Like, so much better. It's actually, like, a legitimate gaming machine right now. I don't have the entry-level configuration. This one is, like, I think like $2,300 of the review unit because it has 32 gigabytes of RAM. But this chip can play Lies of P at the native resolution of the MacBook Pro, which is close to 4K, at 70 FPS. Maxed out graphics. That's pretty ridiculous. If you scale it down to like 1440p, like it was over, I think it was over 100 FPS. 1080p, definitely over 100 FPS, like to fill that 120 hertz refresh rate. Macs are never going to be great gaming machines, but my God, the fact that, you know, a base level MacBook Pro could do this is pretty insane.
So is that just the log line for this M5 MacBook? Like, it's the gaming MacBook, but like, don't expect Macs to do actual heavy, heavy duty gaming.
It's a good lift. Like, what I've noticed is that Apple, with every iteration of its M series chips, it like fixes a little bit and makes certain things a little bit faster. So I think it was one year was like the multi-threading got a lot faster, and then it was like MPU stuff got a little bit better, and now it's both more MPU stuff on the graphics, but also the graphics themselves are just like so much more impressive. So if you're somebody who likes games, you will be able to play a few more games on your MacBook Pro. If you're a content creator rendering video using the GPU, this thing is so much better. Like, it's just that much more powerful. So I think that's the main takeaway. If you need if you're like a hardcore content editor, though, like there may be some justification just waiting a bit for the M5 Pro and M5 Max chips to arrive. That's going to be probably spring, I'd say, like maybe early spring. Apple tends to like time these out a little bit. So this is the base M5 chip. But if you're somebody who needs something more than what the MacBook Air offers, you do maybe a bit of video, a bit of gaming, you just want like a good MacBook Pro, this is a solid one. At the moment, it's kind of weird because if you do want the faster MacBook Pros, you actually have to go back to the M4 Pro and M4 Max chip. So that's just kind of the situation Apple's in right now. It does kind of feel weird because certain things are so much better with the M5, especially the GPU and some MPU side stuff. But yeah. Ben, what are you running right now? Because I think you upgraded a couple of years ago, right?
An M1 Pro. And I knew that as soon as I got this thing, because we were at the very trailhead of the M series chips, that I was going to feel like I was missing out really quickly. And I'm sad to say that I'm right.
You're probably, it's not even that quickly. It's been 4 years, right? So that's about the time. I think that's about the legitimate lifespan of most computers. Like when I ran IT or when I worked in IT stuff, it was typically you cycle things out every 3 to 4 years. For most consumers, 4 to 5 years, that's a good run for a computer. If you're a content creator, though, and you want to like really level up your production and just get stuff out faster, it does pay to upgrade more often. And certainly if you are upgrading from an M1 Pro, bumping up to an M5, you definitely see a difference.
I'd probably want to wait around for the M5 Pro just because, like, happy with what I have right now.
Yeah, exactly. So you're good. You could probably just sit tight for a while. I would say you would just sit tight for a redesign because does the M1 Pro have the new MacBook redesign or is it still running the old?
Oh, no, it has MacBook, like the notch camera situation and like crucially, all the ports that I need. It has the SD card slot. It has the HDMI. It has enough USB-C along with MagSafe. That's why I wanted to get this M1 because I didn't want to get stuck with USB-C only charging.
What a disaster that was. So anyway, if you're still running an Intel Mac or if you have like an early M1 MacBook Pro, this is probably a good upgrade or just wait for the Pro chips and Max chips to arrive. I kind of wish that they fit in an Ethernet port. There is kind of space for it. I've seen some companies do like a Ethernet port that kind of drops down, but Apple's all about solid cases now, so they don't want like movable parts. That's the only thing, because when I do testing for computers, I have gigabit Ethernet. I plug in straight to Ethernet to get those fast updates and everything. That is really nice to have. These don't have, this one doesn't have Wi-Fi 7 yet, which is surprising because that's been around for a while. And Apple does have a Wi-Fi 7 chip that they've put in the iPad and the iPhone. So that's something. That's something I'd expect to see soon. The rumor is that next year we'll probably see the touchscreen upgrade for Macs. And also an OLED upgrade, because right now there's no OLED. These are mini LED screens. So they're very bright, very sharp, but they don't have the like glory of OLED over there. Also, we reviewed the iPad Pro M5. Nate Ingram reviewed it, just says it's a pretty solid speed boost. And, you know, yeah, it's an iPad Pro. How do you feel about the iPad Pro, Ben?
So my partner has an iPad Pro, a much older one, mostly used for drawing and like browsing the web and such. My big question when it comes to iPad Pros recently is, it's basically a computer now, right? Like, it's got the M5 chip. It's got the ability to put a couple of windows next to each other in the same way that all of the touchscreen Windows laptops have been able to do for a long time. I think the big issue is finding a good third-party keyboard that you can attach to the iPad. I certainly wouldn't suggest it as someone's only college like work machine, because I've certainly seen videos of like the elder iPad babies trying to bring just a iPad to school. Yeah. Where do you think the limitations are for an iPad versus like a MacBook Air? Because it just seems wrong to me, but I don't know exactly what's wrong.
You're right that it's more computer-like now with iPad OS 26. They essentially, they have a dock at the bottom. You can window switch. You can put windows side by side. I think the iPad Pro, so like, I don't think it's a super successful tablet lineup because it's so expensive. They start above $1,000. Now they're as fast as a MacBook. But it's like, yeah, if you get a MacBook Air, you have a pretty light system. You can't do touchscreen stuff, but you have a pretty light system. That is just, you open it up and it is a computer. You could do everything you want with it. You have a keyboard, you have a trackpad. You could get some work done. I think Apple, it took them way too long to turn the iPad and iPad OS into like a legitimate operating system. It always felt like a baby version of Mac OS. Like you could only run maybe one or two apps side by side. Background processes, you're screwed. If you're rendering a video, in the past, like you have this powerful system that can only, you have to focus on that window. You can't just like tab away and do stuff. I think they're starting to fix that with iPad OS 26 and these newer systems, but they just feel inherently limiting to me. And I feel like the only reason it exists is because, hey, Apple found a reason to charge over $1,000 for an iPad. That's pretty much it. The base iPad is so like, you get so much of the same functionality from the base $350 iPad. If you want something a little better, with a slightly better screen, the iPad Air is there. As soon as they bring ProMotion and like the faster refresh rates down to other iPads, like the iPad Air, I don't see a selling point for the iPad Pro. I don't know anybody who would really benefit with that rather than spending a little more and getting a MacBook Pro or a MacBook Air, unless you just love that touchscreen. You just love that touchscreen so much. I don't know.
Because it's a weird Apple machine. Hasn't yeah. actually been the most Apple they can be in this case and made sure that like only the Apple Pencil works with the iPad Pro. Like you can get an Apple Pencil. You can do whatever you want on whatever iPad that you want. So if you're an artist or something who wants to do heavier duty things, but you're not at the point of using something like a Wacom or similar tablet, then that's what you use. But I think that if you are doing that sort of heavy duty art, and hopefully you continue doing it in spite of AI, you're probably going to outgrow the iPad really quickly.
Probably, like unless you have a specific use case, like you're saying. I don't see the point of the iPad Pro. It's a weird system. It's just like Apple overcharging for a tablet. If you want something better than the base iPad, the iPad Air is right there. It's a shame about the ProMotion screen. I feel like that's the only thing here. Yeah.
And then speaking of things that might not have an actual user base, there's a new Vision Pro. How do you feel about that?
there's a new Vision Pro, and you know, I feel about like the way I felt about the first one. This is not a consumer product. This is a dev kit. This is a developer kit. It's still $3,500. It has the M5 chip. It has a new dual knit band, and I've been testing it lately, and that band is amazing. That band is what the Vision Pro should have launched with. And we talked about this before. The original Vision Pro was just such a marketing failure. Like, it's because Apple couldn't help themselves and they had to sell this thing. It's like, oh man, look at this amazing new headset that people can buy. Rather than being like, hey, we're making this thing. It's really expensive. And this is like where we could be headed. Don't sell it as a big commercial, right? Don't sell it as a thing that's in Apple stores that you can buy as a major product, because it didn't make sense for anybody but developers to buy the original Vision Pro. And that still holds true for this one. It's still too expensive. Vision OS is getting some new stuff. They're adding some new immersive content, but you know, the apps aren't quite there. This is the thing you buy if you're figuring out how to like build stuff for spatial computing and for Vision OS and for stuff down the line.
I think, or if you have a lot of money and you want a weird but great way of watching movies.
It is. I mean, it is just so overpriced for that, because you could just get a Quest 3. You could just get a Quest 3 and do that without even, you know, having a battery pack, right? And just like sit anywhere and have like a completely contained experience.
Well, yeah, but a Quest 3 is not Apple stuff. Like, it all comes back to the idea that Apple is also a luxury brand on top of being a computer hardware manufacturer.
No, it's definitely luxury brand stuff. It's just like, you know, we're going to talk about the Samsung Galaxy XR as well, which is $1,800. This is the first Android XR headset, and it's funny to see that debut right after this refresh Vision Pro. I don't think the Galaxy XR is like that exciting either. But what is interesting is that Samsung and Google are literally just copying the Vision Pro, right? It's similar form factor, similar micro LED display, similar pinch gestures, similar virtualized avatars and things like that. They aren't doing anything different. They're literally just doing everything Apple did here, and that Meta has done some of this stuff too. They just made it $1,800. That's not affordable. That's still not affordable. I don't think that makes it seem like Samsung or anybody is winning, because Google does not have a platform with Android XR. There's not much content there. We did some hands-ons with it. Sam took a look at it for us. Google Maps is interactive. Google Photos has an XR app, but otherwise they're like, yeah, you can run Android apps. So you're going to buy an $1,800 headset to run like a flat 2D plain Android app?
Cool. Nice.
None of that makes... That's amazing. That's so fantastic. They're like, oh yeah, you could hook it up to a computer as well. I think the MacBook integration of the Vision Pro is like a really cool thing, and something that if they can produce a cheaper headset, people will buy it just for that, like the X-Real glasses. But being able to virtualize a Mac display wherever you are and make it giant is fantastic. We don't have a sense of how Google's going to do that, or how Samsung will do that with the Galaxy XR, because they didn't really talk about it. They're like, you can mirror your PC. And that's kind of all they're saying.
So when we're writing the history of computers in some number of years, are we going to say that the Vision Pro was the first major platform to have these small pinch and swipe gestures that don't completely take you out of like polite society and make you look like you're, you know, reaching toward weird stuff? Because like, I'm sure that there were smaller companies that were also working on these very minute gestures, but they probably got gobbled up by, you know, the big fish pretty quickly. So
in fairness, Meta did have finger tracking in beta testing for several years on the Oculus Rift, and like those, they're years ago, subsequent headsets, they had finger tracking. The thing about the Vision Pro is that it has underside cameras like underneath the main lens, so it sees your fingers wherever you are, even if it's on like your lap. So yeah, that's essentially what Samsung is doing with the Galaxy XR. It seems like a lot of what the Android XR things are going to be doing. What Meta's doing with the Ray-Ban display is like, yeah, it's the wrist sensor, so that it's basically detecting the vibration of your taps and movements with your hand, which is very different. And I think it's another thing. It's another thing you have to wear and charge. I don't think that actually makes any of this simpler. I will also say broadly, this entire market, like, I don't think you have to get this thing under $500, like, to make people want to buy something like a Vision Pro. I don't think we're ever going to get there with XR headsets, because VR headsets have been pretty good for a while. And the Quest 2 and Quest 3 have sold really well. But it's not going to everybody. They're not exactly mainstream. They're going to the people who want an affordable VR experience. That's it. So the real question is, like, what do you do when you have these headsets? What are you building towards? And I think both Apple and Google are kind of building towards future spatial computing goggles, XR glasses, similar to the Ray-Ban display, but even more complex. So you got to do the work now to have to lay the groundwork to build those devices in the future. And that's basically where they're at. So in conclusion, nobody should buy the Vision Pro. Nobody should buy the Galaxy XR. But it is interesting to see Apple kind of make these changes. And the M5 chip is going to be much faster than the M2. I noticed that creating the personas was faster, doing some rendering stuff like a little faster. But if you are a developer that already has a Vision Pro, the only thing you need is the new strap. The dual knit band is fantastic. It's $100, and you could just plop it into the old model and you'll be great. Yeah. So anyway, I'll have a full review of the Vision Pro, the new M5 Vision Pro soon. Stay tuned for that. All right, let's move on to what we're working on. And yeah, I'm working on a final review of the Vision Pro. We're doing a lot of prep for CES too. Like, that is, my God, that is a couple of months away, and we got to do the planning now. So I'm thinking about January. I'm thinking about, like, what's ahead there. I'm also thinking about, like, you know, we're doing planning for the Sundance Film Festival, like how I'll cover that remotely. So doing some work around that. This is like a mop-up period of Techtober. But then, yeah, Samsung decided to launch a VR headset, an XR headset. So I have a commentary around that as well. Basically the points I made here, but that thing, I have no hope for that thing, and I have no hope for Android XR, because look at what Google did with VR, with Daydream, with Google Cardboard, with Google Stadia. This is not a serious company when it comes to, like, launching new platforms.
Just say the word, Google Graveyard.
Google Graveyard. I mean, but I gotta point out, like, all of these are things that they heavily backed and they just, like, abandoned. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with Android XR, but I have no hope, because they're not doing anything new. The people who are doing new things, I mean, Meta is doing new stuff. I don't always agree with the direction they're heading in, but they're doing it, and Apple's doing some thoughtful stuff. Maybe it's not as much new stuff as Meta, but they're at least trying to push it forward. So anyway, go check out that piece. All right, let's go to our picks for the week. I forget, did I mention Frankenstein last week?
No, you didn't.
I don't think I did. I saw an early screening of Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, and that's going to be airing on Netflix in early November. It's out in limited release now. If you like science fiction, if you like dark fantasy, gothic fantasy, and you like Guillermo del Toro, you owe it to yourself to go see this thing in the theater. It is a beautiful adaptation of Frankenstein. It's also a movie that I think Guillermo del Toro was basically born to make, because he really leans on the daddy issues. He leans on the gothic sensibilities that are just, like, inherent in Frankenstein. It's really, really well done. Oscar Isaac is fantastic, and Jacob Elordi plays the monster. He's also very good, too. Like, I think Jacob Elordi, fascinating actor, somebody I was introduced to because I used to watch the show. What was that show? Utopia? Euphoria.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I used
yeah.
to watch Euphoria. So that's where he was big. And he was the main villain of that show. Like, he was big, abusive, shitty jock guy. And to see him, like, go off and do interesting stuff, even though dude is, like, crafted like an Adonis, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool that he is taking chances too. So he is a good Frankenstein vampire monster.
He's also like 6'7", right? So he's physically imposing, not just jacked.
He's huge. So he is perfect. They kind of do some interesting things with the monster because they didn't show him too clearly in the trailers. But he looks a little bit like an anime character, like still monstrous, but also something you can imagine, you know, people pining after or finding some sort of affection towards, which is, of course, what happens in the story too. So yeah, Frankenstein is fantastic. You see it on Netflix if that's your only option, but it is worth driving to a theater or heading to a theater to check this thing out, because it's a gorgeous film. Yeah. Anything you want to shout out, Ben?
I got two things. One is really small, but I want to start by talking about the new Military Gun album, God Save the Gun. This is nominally a hardcore punk band. if you are a longtime listener, you know that I got back into hardcore basically with like Turnstile and kept on going with that. The guy who did this album, who started the band Military Gun, was also in this other band called Regional Justice Center, I think. That's a power violence band. That is, like, their songs are, like, 38 seconds long, and they're all mm-hmm. just like, ah! Like, yeah, everyone yeah. is going as hard as they can on their drums and bass and guitar and all of that. And like, there's a long held thing in this scene that like everyone doing like really abrasive music also has this like little melodic side project that they hope is going to take off, because I think it's just really nice to see people like sing along to like big catchy hooks. Aside from the fact that that's also just like more marketable, more profitable if you want a career as a musician. So that was the idea behind Military Gun. Let's take some of the sensibility of hardcore punk and make it more fun to sing along to. It sounds a little bit like Blink-182. It sounds a little bit like... there were people who made some connections between this band and Britpop, which was kind of interesting. Check out the song God Owes Me Money. It's about the singer band leader's messed up childhood. Like, really good hook there, really good synths. I'm just really enjoying this album. It's like a vocal forward kind of power punk album, not power pop. The second thing that I have to suggest is that it's obviously Over the Garden Wall season. If you haven't yes. watched it, go watch yes. it. It is the perfect fall viewing. I love to see that every year, all of the entertainment sites are doing like yearly send-ups now. We're in the part of the this is a loved piece of media cycle where people are doing like oral histories and stuff. Like, it's gotten to the point where it's near unimpeachable, and I love that for them.
It's great. Is it streaming on HBO Max now? Because it was like, it disappeared for a while, I think.
I think it may be streaming on HBO Max. I also have a copy of it on my computer because I just don't want to lose it.
You don't want to lose it. Buy stuff you love, folks. Another mantra of this show. Ben, are you a fan of Joji?
You mean Papa Franco?
Filthy Frank. Filthy Frank. That guy has come a long way from being...
Yeah, yeah. No, I know about I know about Joji's music career, and I know that he's got a new album out too. Or is it just a single?
It's just a single so far. It's called Pixelated Kisses, but it's a banger. TikTok turned me on to it, but I didn't realize like it is the Filthy Frank guy. It is the guy who popularized the Harlem Shake. So dude has come a long way from YouTube meme lord.
There's kind of an interesting connection between like Military Gun and Joji, though, because these are two people who are trying to shed their like more abrasive pasts and make something that is more like thoughtful and polished and, yeah, you could say more marketable, but I don't want to focus on that.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard some Joji stuff before. Like, it was there's some kind of like weepy emo stuff he does. I like his synth. Pixelated Kisses is like a very like it's a wall of sound. It's a wall of sound. Reminds me of like early Sleigh Bells stuff. So it's good. It's a good song to like just jam out to. But also, if you have good headphones and good speakers, that went straight on my headphone testing playlist, because like it just like fills you with sound. Reminds me of when I was like, it was South by 1 year. I got to be like front row at Sleigh Bells. Like front of the crowd, basically. But they also do stacks of speakers, like more than most folks. So, yeah, I probably lost a bit of my hearing that night, but it was worth it. Wear earplugs, kids.
Fun fact, Sleigh Bells, also a melodic side project of a metal guy.
Yes, yes. It all connects, but I think I like the melodic projects more than their actual metal source work. So, yeah, good picks, Ben, and I think we can wrap.
thanks everybody for listening. This was a great episode, so thanks for sticking around for it. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I talk about movies and TV at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Send me your melodic side projects on Blue Sky at HeyBellman. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
Thanks, folks. We're out.